It's getting to the point to where it's laughable that Department of Education and the loan servicers can stand there and say, hey, someone, you don't need to pay for help. We have loan counselors here at these companies that are all being sued multiple times to help you. And here's this studentloans.aid.gov website for you to look at, and you can read all this material. And they expect that the average person just to be able to decipher it all on their own. I mean, it's convoluted, it's complex. And you add on to that the bureaucracy and the fact that the loan servicers just drop the ball left and right, and quite frankly, are misleading borrowers when they call in. It's no wonder that private student loans have a lower default rate than federal student loans.
Hello and welcome to the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I am so excited today to have Jantz Hoffman, the founder, how would you describe it? The Certified Student Loan Professional designation?
Yeah, the CSA Board of Standards. It's the nonprofit organization that does the educational component and oversees the designation.
Yeah, so I met Jantz at a conference of a bunch of flat fee fiduciary financial planners, and was really interested and really impressed with just his knowledge. And so I thought, hey, let's have him on the show, right?
Yeah, you can never have too many people talking about student loans, right?
Exactly. So, I mean, people just love listening to student loans. I mean, we start talking about complicated loopholes, it's going to get people really excited. So we got to be a little bit careful. So just to kick off today's episode, I thought that you would just to introduce kind of a little bit of a crazy idea that might get our podcast shut down. How does someone defraud the government taking out student loans?
Well, we talked a little bit about this off air, and Heather and I, who's also on the board of the designation, we had a little sidebar about this as well. And recently there was an article that came out about student loan borrowers falsifying the documents on their income-driven repayment plans and overstating their family size. They found that I think a handful of individuals had said they had 99 people that were in their family, in their house, that weren't necessarily living with them, right? Other people. And there was a pretty big article about it and some uproar as to people defrauding the government and there not being enough oversight of these plans. It's kind of funny because, you know, you look at 44 million people, and if five people were doing this, like, what is that as a percentage of people? And then when you really think through it, what are they benefiting from this? So they're not making student loan payments, but they're accruing interest. They have an increasing loan balance. If they're going to have to do this for, what, 20 or 25 years to get any value from it, you know, even still, if they did get some value from it, they're likely going to owe taxes on the amount that's forgiven. And be right back in the spot where they began with anyway. So there's not a lot of value to be gained from that and a lot of risk with potential 5 years in prison for lying on the forms.
And you said the best way is just to open a for-profit college and get a bunch of people to take out student loans from your institution, right?
Yeah. If you really want to say, how do you defraud the government using student loans? It's not as a borrower. I mean, most of the money you take out goes directly to the school to pay for tuition, room, board, and whatnot. You may get a few thousand dollars a semester in living expenses, but that's a small fraction of the total amount you borrow. If you really want to make money defrauding the government on student loans, you open a quasi-scam for-profit university and then let it get a whole bunch of other people take out the debt in their names, and you just reap the benefits of giving them a worthless education from that Corinthian college school that then closes.
Well, you know, and all this is our own opinions, right? So before all the lawyers send us the letters, this is our own opinion. People love, especially the super aggressive people in the industry, they're making tons of money. They love sending me letters. It's funny. So you know, the thing that blew me away is there was a recent, for what listeners that don't know, the scandal that Jantz is kind of referencing is there was a bunch of borrowers that were working with this kind of scammy student loan help, quote unquote, group. And the way that they were getting people $0 a month payments on their IBR applications. And the way they were doing that is, you know, you get about a $50 per month reduction in your payments for every child that you have, right? And so their genius idea was that since no one is monitoring the forms, because we know how foolish and incompetent the servicers are, because no one was monitoring these forms, then the best way to get a $0 payment is just to say that you have 93 people in your family size. And so that was like the headline for one of the GAO reports that came out of, I guess maybe several months ago at this point, was that this program is so poorly administered that nobody thought that that was a bad thing. That somebody put that they had 93 children on their income-driven repayment application. That's just a really hilarious. And I think, you know, you're kind of mentioning, you know, the best way to defraud the government is to have one of these schools that's charging people ridiculous tuitions because you can only borrow so much as a borrower, right?
Right, exactly. And if you really look at it, like those individuals that were working with those firms that were falsifying the documents for them, let's say 2 or 3 years down the road, they're no longer falsifying their documents, because if they ever filled out the forms themselves, they would be highly unlikely to put that large number of a family size on there. And all they've done is punish themselves, because they just have a whole bunch of interest that they haven't paid that's accumulated into the total amount that they owe. And now they go back probably to paying their loans off. So the only one that was getting value out of that was potentially the college that they went to that received those dollars, or, you know, that firm that likely charged them, what do you think, $1,000 or so to help them falsify documents and potentially go to jail. I mean, that's,
yeah,
there wasn't a lot of value for the borrower. So this is a problem that I have, as a lot of what gets reported in the media, is a lot of it kind of tells half truths in a way that affects borrowers' behavior that can be very detrimental and affect public policy, right? We see things that come out and we think, oh, this is really bad when you do something like this. But if you take a look at a bigger picture, maybe it's not as large of a problem than the headline actually makes it appear to be.
Well, yeah. And I have to say, like, in the student loan world, it really does kind of seem like you have to murder somebody to get any kind of negative attention. And even then, you might get a slap on the wrist. You know, a couple examples of this, like, so University of Phoenix had a settlement with the government recently that basically they made a bunch of advertisements and they put all of these like Fortune 500 type brands on their advertisement, kind of implying like, here's where our graduates, you know, get jobs. And like, you know, we have these deep relationships with all these corporate partners, right? And it was totally misleading that the government found. And basically, they were just using these logos, right? Like Adobe and Microsoft and all these places that people would want to work at, to try to tell them, like, this is the secret to working here, is getting our degree. And the settlement was just ridiculous, in my opinion, just because all they did was just say that you have to forgive all of the debt held by the institution, right? So it didn't affect any private or federal student loans. It only affected the debt held by basically the school itself, right? And so that's just kind of a made up number anyway. I mean, you're just going to make up debt that somebody owes. And then the worst part too is, I think that there's this 10% rule where you have to have at least 10% of funds, I think, coming from outside the federal government to qualify for federal aid. And so naturally, if you just come up with a loan that people owed to the institution, you can lose 100% on that loan. And as long as you keep access to federal aid, that's super profitable. Right.
Oh, right. The federal student aid is the moneymaker. It's the cash cow. If the school loses access to that, they might as well close the doors.
Right. Right. I mean, that's the for-profit side. And there's certainly a lot of abuses on that side. I like to also focus on the not-for-profit school abuses, because I think a lot of institutions are sort of like acting kind of like big research hospitals in some regards, where it's like, oh, like you claim, you know, that you're going to help me, and like the Saint so-and-so's name is spread across the hospital title right at the top of the building, but yet you still send me a CT scan bill for like $60,000, right? So I mean, right. It's a little bit kind of like that for the not-for-profits too, but also on websites. So we recently had the FTC have a settlement against this company, LendEDU, that basically, according to the allegations, was faking reviews. So they were just having all their friends and family leave fake reviews online, selling refinancing placements to the highest lender or highest bidder, and then also manufactured a fake student loan expert named Drew Cloud a couple years before that was kind of representing himself as a real person to the media when he was in fact not a real person at all. And yet the media kind of fell for it. So, I mean, there's all kinds of sketchiness going on at multiple levels. You know, you've got the sort of consolidation scam places, you've got the websites that are acting a little shady, and then you have these schools that are just getting, best case scenario, slaps on the wrist for just, in my opinion, taking hundreds of millions and if not billions of dollars from all of us as taxpayers. So it's really kind of a Wild West world, and it's really fun and refreshing to find somebody that cares about it for the right reasons. So just to jump in a little bit more, I guess, first of all, who are you and what do you do, and how did you get involved in the student loan world?
So I have been advising student loan borrowers for almost 10 years. I started in 2010, so I'm coming up on a 10-year anniversary of doing this. I've been working in financial services since 2002. At the point in time that I got involved with student loans, I was a partner in a commodity trading advisory with the former Business Conduct Chairman of the Chicago Board of Exchange. And I had a dear friend of mine that had gone to vet school, had way more student debt than she could handle, and was being called by collections companies on her federal loans and collection companies on her private loans, and didn't really know what to do. Income-based repayment at that point in time had only been available for maybe 7 or 8 months. So there wasn't a lot of information about it. And certainly the processes to utilize those plans were nothing like they are now. As bad as the environment is for borrowers now, it is markedly better than it was 10 years ago. So for her, I just wanted to help. So I got involved trying to help her out, learned about income-based repayment, sort of navigated a direct consolidation for her. And at that point in time, there was no studentloans.gov website to do a online consolidation. That had to be done with paper forms, which was really difficult to get all the information because the servicers didn't really provide the information. There wasn't a NSLDS to go get one consolidated place for your loans at that point in time. It was a real mess. So I helped her through the process. And then next thing I know, her coworker needed help. And then someone else from their other vet office needed help. Before I know it, the New York Times was calling me to interview me about student loans and what was going on in the student loan marketplace. I was on the PBS's Nightly Business Report. So I took a step back, really dove into the world of student loans. My first experience, again, was with those individuals and seeing what a disastrous situation they were facing with servicers and the loan counselors and just the bureaucracy that existed. It was quite clear that help was needed. From there, I ended up working as a consultant for a number of broker-dealer firms. At one point, there was about 1,000 to 1,500 financial advisors that were with a couple of different agencies that when they had clients that had student loans, they would bring them for me to me for case design to help them sort of navigate what their options were and make recommendations to their clients. But it was challenging because most of those financial advisors had little to no knowledge about student debt at all, similar to what I had in knowledge probably 6 months before. So I had actually created training material for the advisors that I was supporting because they were making promises to clients that simply weren't true, you know, giving them advice or not understanding the recommendations that I was explaining to them within the plan that they were delivering to clients. So I created this training material, and this really became the basis for what is the CSLP course now. Over time, you know, obviously it's matured and there's been more material added for these financial advisors and accountants. Heather joining the organization a couple of years ago was a great addition to have all of her knowledge and expertise in there as well. You know, that's been my story. Now I sit on the board of that nonprofit. I also have my own investment advisory firm where I do some work with borrowers and clients myself. And I'm a partner in a technology company that's created some software to help people analyze student loan repayment options.
Yeah, that's quite a lot. And so I think that your solution to the problem was, hey, I've been consulting for all of these advisors out there, so I'm going to create a designation specific to student loans that's really more advisor focused versus, you know, for consumers, right?
Yeah, you know, when you really dive into the material, you find that student loans is so interconnected to the rest of financial planning, tax planning. And unfortunately, consumer literacy is not that great in our country. So a lot of the topics that student loans indirectly touches and draws upon and affects payments and vice versa are material that a lot of consumers aren't familiar with or aren't comfortable talking about. Also, to learn, it's a pretty big investment of time to learn all this material. And it's much easier to teach a financial professional, an accountant, or an investment advisor representative this information that they can use multiple times to help lots of people than it is to go direct to the source and teach all of this information to consumers that maybe don't bring the background that a financial professional would.
Yeah, I mean, I know we have some financial professionals that listen to the podcast, so I would certainly support anybody getting this CSLP designation. We paid for one of our consultants to do it, and another one of our consultants came to us already having that. And it's a good course. It's a good piece of information. So let's talk about some loopholes, some of the ideas, some of which I got the first idea from you on, actually. So I have to give you credit for some of these. So the first one that you kind of helped convince me of is amending old tax returns. So the idea being that if you file taxes, married filing separately, for some payment plans like pay-as-you-earn, you can exclude your spouse's income. But sometimes that results in you having to pay more taxes than if you filed jointly. So walk us through your philosophy on amending older tax returns to get refunds when people have done that for student loan purposes.
Yeah, well, let's first clarify, Travis, that neither one of us are CPAs, and this is not tax advice for anybody, right?
Good disclosure.
Yeah, so what is true is on the income-driven repayment plan forms, the loan servicers calculate the payment based upon the most recently completed tax return and the filing status on that return. The servicers do not care if you filed married separate in, say, 2018, and maybe today you just filed your tax return for 2019 married joint. You go to renew your income-driven repayment plan. The servicer does not care that you filed separately 2 years ago. They're going to calculate that payment off of both spouses' income this year because you filed joint on your most recently completed return. That's also the case if it's the other way around. If you meet an individual that maybe they got married, filed jointly because they didn't know the difference, their payment jumped up. If they file a subsequent return separate, they could get back to having the payment calculated on their income alone. So the way the form is designed, the most recently completed tax return dictates whether or not the loan servicer calculates the payment based upon just the borrower's income or the borrower and their spouse's income. And the IRS allows borrowers to amend their tax return up to 3 years after the tax filing date. So if a tax return is no longer the most recently completed return, for the purpose of student loan payment calculations, it's not relevant any longer, but it's still within the window where that return can be amended within the IRS's rules. And it's one of the, I would say, loopholes or challenges when you deal with different arms of the government that have overlapping programs with different rules that create these gray areas as to what income is and how payments are calculated. And as advisors, we have to help our clients understand the differences and the nuances between the different administrations and help them make the determination and decisions that are best for their long-term finances. And that could take into account something like this. We're talking about amending tax returns if it's no longer relevant for student loan purposes. Now, the IRS only allows you to amend a return from married separate to married joint. You're not allowed to amend the return from married joint to married separate. So what you'll see oftentimes is you'll walk in to individuals and they've already filed a joint return. There's nothing you can really do for them until the following year when they have an opportunity to file a subsequent return. You can't amend that return from joint to separate and then get them that benefit, say, in, you know, June 15th.
Yeah, I think that the people that you'd really want to look at this for are people that have a, you know, multi-thousand dollar penalty for filing separate or greater, right? And the idea is what we've kind of done to tell people when to do it is once your tax return is 2 years old, go back and amend it. So in other words, once you've already certified with a new return that says married filing separate, you're no longer using that older return in the certification process, then it's okay to go back and change that. Now, this is a gray area. I mean, this could end up, we could get guidance at some point that this is not allowed, but there's nothing blatantly dishonest about this. It's certainly not in the spirit of the law. That's true. But there's a lot of debate amongst tax professionals as, you know, you follow what the law is versus what the law was intended to be, right? Especially if you can save money doing it. So initially, I was a little skeptical of this strategy, but I've kind of come around a little bit when thinking about what the actual questions actually ask.
Right. And I think it does, as you say, it depends upon what the tax consequences are of your tax filing status. I think it depends somewhat on how comfortable your accountant or CPA is with the strategy. You know, for some individuals, amending a return and throwing another tax return through the IRS's automated audit system is not a good idea, regardless of the tax difference. Right. There's not a higher risk of audit filing separately or filing joint or amending a return than there is in any one of the other returns. But you're running another return through that same system and every return has a risk of being audited. So in effect, you are doubling your audit risk because you're running that same return through twice. And depending upon where that return falls in the likelihood of being audited based upon deductions or business incomes or what that taxpayer is doing, is also going to be part of the determination whether or not an accountant or the client should determine or decide to amend the return.
Yeah, another interesting loophole that you talk about is this pay, repay, filing separate loophole, right? So this one we found pretty useful for our clients pursuing public service loan forgiveness. So can you kind of explain when it would make sense to file separately and have one spouse on pay and one spouse on repay?
Yeah, so the revised pay-as-you-earn plan is actually a really interesting plan, and the administration of it is different than the other income-driven repayment plans. In that plan, the payment is always calculated on both spouses' income, and the payment is then split proportionate to the two spouses' debts. However, there's no requirement that both spouses are on that particular plan. So one spouse could choose to have that plan. The payment is calculated on the joint income, and then they have a payment based upon whatever percent of the total amount owed between the two spouses is theirs. The other spouse could be in particular any plan when they reference that number. However, for some borrowers, previous to the revised pay-as-you-earn plan, you would really have to weigh the value of including spouses' income. So if we had a borrower that was not a very good income-driven repayment plan candidate, maybe they had income two times their debt. So let's say they had low income. Let's say they had $40,000 in income and $20,000 of student debt, but they were married to somebody who maybe had $200,000 in student debt and $100,000 in income. The individual who was not a good income-driven repayment candidate on their own would be a good income-driven repayment plan candidate if their income and debt were combined with their spouse's, but it is valuable for them in that plan because there's really siphoning value off of their spouse's debt-to-income ratio. So what you can now do with the pay-as-you-earn and revised pay-as-you-earn is you can have the spouse who is the great income-driven repayment plan candidate go into a plan where they file separately, where their payment is calculated on their own income to their own debt. And then you can have the other spouse enter into revised pay-as-you-earn and still get the value as they would if they would have both been in, say, pay-as-you-earn filing joint before. So it's an interesting loophole to take advantage of.
Yeah, so I think hopefully we still have people, right? Because it's a kind of a complicated yeah. It's a kind of a complicated loophole. So we had a client save $12,000 a year with this loophole this week. And here's kind of what the situation looked like. So the one spouse was in fellowship, it was both physicians, right? One spouse was in fellowship, one spouse was done. They had the same debt. So like say $250K each, just hypothetical numbers here, right? And so if you looked at their income split, so if you did repay for both of them, their payment's about, let's say it was $3,000 was their overall repay payment, right? And so since that that's get split proportionally based on the size of your debt, that payment's $1,500 on each of their loans. Right. Even though one spouse is making tons of money, one spouse is making fellowship level money, the payment would be split equally on their loans. Now, when the spouse that filed married filing separately did that, that payment instead of $1,500 a month was basically about $500 a month. Right. So the thing that matters is your overall payment. And so because this person was in fellowship and had a much lower income than the other spouse, the person, if you filed separately, could be on pay as you earn and paying $500 a month instead of $1,500. And the high income spouse, even though they were making such a high income on their own, they would have been paying probably $2,500 a month or something like that, right? Because they were making such a high income relative to their debt. But because that they were married to a low income individual, that actually got their payment down a lot lower. So their overall PSLF payment was $2,000 instead of $3,000. So I think that kind of like highlights why this stuff matters. It's a kind of a random loophole, but if it does apply to you, that was, you know, $12,000 a year that these people saved. I mean, and that's per year over the next 5 years. That's like $60,000 in projected savings or $72,000, I guess, in or 60. I mean, I can't do math anymore. It's been a long time since I've been a bond trader, Chance. You know, $60,000 in projected savings. That's pretty significant. Feel free to respond to that.
Well, yeah. And you know, I actually was working with a couple of clients last night. And most of these loopholes that we're talking about are really on the more complex cases where you have two clients, both with student loans, varying incomes, varying debt amounts. And that's when, you know, these nuances really can make a huge value. But working with someone that understands how the plans work is so important. So I was with a client last night that I was kind of expecting a similar outcome. In their budget, we had a little over $1,000 a month to play with 401k contributions between the two of them. And we were really looking about how that 401k contribution would benefit them between who makes it. Do they split it evenly? These two also are in a community property state, so there's some other complexities there. But there was a lot of numbers that had to be run to come to the determination of who and how they would best be served utilizing the money in their budget to keep their student loan payment down with those pre-tax contributions.
Yeah, that's interesting to me because it's just like, we can't necessarily predict all the time, like if somebody's going to have a really interesting loophole that they can use, or, you know, if somebody really needed student loan advice, like we try to do a pretty good job of screening that when somebody asks us, you know, about if they should use our service. Like we want people that are obvious, simple cases not to use our service so that the people who do use it will be super excited and want to tell everybody in the world about it. You know, you just have to be willing in life. I think if you're thinking like a business professional, you want to pay for advice in some cases when the result is not an amazing response. So for example, like I recently had our corporate structure evaluated and was fine paying for that advice because I did not want to miss anything because I'm not an expert in, you know, C corp versus S corp business structures. So it's like, well, if I could potentially pay a lot less in taxes, if I have the right corporate structure, that's worth getting that evaluated by somebody who knows those rules in detail so that I'm not making a huge mistake and paying way more than I need to. You know what I mean?
Right. And if you get a big thumbs up, you know, hey, you're doing a good job and just get a big thumbs up because you did everything right. That's valuable in itself too. It's harder to perceive the value as much versus, you know, one of the scam companies that say, hey, we can lower your payment to zero because we're going to lie on the form and potentially put you in jail for 5 years because we say you got 96 kids living in your house.
Well, it's funny because like if you look at the analogy to like healthcare, like if you go to the gastroenterologist, you get your colonoscopy and they're like, hey, no polyps, you know, you're good, no cancer. People are like, yes, you love paying that bill. But then you go to your financial advisor and you want to kind of basically do the same thing. Like, is your situation a disaster and can it be treated if it is? And you get the clean bill of health and people are like, I wanted some super secret loophole. I'm so mad. It's like, no, that's probably a good thing if you're not paying, you know, an arm and a leg for that help. It is really kind of interesting because like the wealth building focused people that we work with definitely have that mindset of like, it makes sense to hire expert advice when you need it. And the people that are very worried are never going to build significant wealth, they very much think more in terms of cost versus value. Not to say that you don't want to pay the lowest price for something possible, but it is pretty amusing. And while we're on that vein too, some of these loopholes that we're talking about, you know, I remember doing my first couple hundred student loan consults and I was honestly not aware of some of these loopholes or had not thought through them in great depth after, you know, the first couple hundred plans that I did. And yet a lot of people are out there getting financial advice from advisors that might have only seen a couple dozen student loan plans in their career and would miss something like this that would be rather expensive to miss, I think.
Without a doubt, you know, there's a lot of people and a lot of clients that I work with, they get referred to me after maybe talking to three or four different advisors or two or three accountants, because this is their concern. That's what they want help with. And they're not necessarily getting good advice. Oftentimes they're saying, hey, I actually know more about my student loans than this financial professional is. And that's a problem because I don't know anything about the student loans, they say. Even on what we consider quote unquote simple cases, for most borrowers, it's still very complex and it's still very difficult for them to determine whether or not they should be paying their loans off, they should look for a private refinance, or they should be using an income-driven repayment plan. Even in what we consider a simple case, someone that, you know, maybe has debt twice their income currently, there's still a lot of complexity because that life is going to change based upon their goals and personal expectations over the future, whether they're going to get married in the future, if they're going to start a business, how their income's going to change. There's still a lot of complexity there that most borrowers probably aren't comfortable trying to figure out and navigate on their own.
Sure. Do you ever see ICR ever make sense for somebody that's not a Parent Plus borrower?
Yes, actually. And it's a short-term value here. So you're probably familiar with the temporary public service loan forgiveness plan that exists. So there's this limited pool of money to forgive student debt for those people that have worked in the public sector, but maybe were in the wrong repayment plan. But they have to be in an income-driven repayment plan for at least 1 year. And because ICR doesn't have a partial financial hardship calculation, and you can file separately and exclude spouse's income, that's an opportunity to get into an income-driven repayment plan. You may have a high payment for a year, but you can get your check the box off of your 1 year in an income-driven repayment plan for temporary public service loan forgiveness.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
you may also see the rarely ever used 12-year standard payment based upon a federal family deduction amount come into play as well, because that may actually be a lower payment than the payment based on income to get you to qualify for 1 year to have the temporary public service loan forgiveness.
Yeah. So again, complex. I mean, it's kind of disgusting, but Jance, when people like you and me, like bond trader, former commodities trader, are attracted to a problem, you know, it needs to be reformed, you know?
Right.
Like, you know,
the problem is it's been reformed number of times over years. And every time they do it, they just make it more complex by creating different versions of the same plan and different eligibilities, that it's getting to the point to where it's laughable that Department of Education and the loan servicers can stand there and say, hey, someone, you don't need to pay for help. We have loan counselors here at these companies that are all being sued multiple times to help you. And, you know, here's this studentloans.aid.gov website for you to look at, and you can read all this material. And they expect that the average person just to be able to decipher it all on their own. I mean, it's convoluted, it's complex. And you add on to that the bureaucracy and the fact that the loan servicers just drop the ball left and right, and quite frankly, are misleading borrowers when they call in. It's no wonder that private student loans have a lower default rate than federal student loans.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. What are some of the things you're seeing right now with your clients, with the servicers? What kind of problems are they having?
Let's see. I had a client this week who we were changing from income-based repayment to revised pay-as-you-earn. Seems like it should be a very simple process, right? We just change repayment plans. The income-driven repayment plan form now has the ability for you to check the box to switch plans for the reduced forbearance payment. That wasn't always the case. So a lot of clients that I had when pay-as-you-earn first became available were on income-based, and we switched them over. But income-based repayment has this quirky rule where in order to leave that plan, you either have to go to a standard 10-year repayment amount, or you have to make a one-time reduced negotiated payment with your loan servicer. And back then they were the worst, because they're the worst at everything. But they would start at like, hey, okay, we'll give you, your payment's supposed to be in a 10-year term, $3,000 a month. How about you make $2,000? How about $1,500? How about interest only? And then finally, they would settle in the lowest number that they could take, which was $5. Now you can just check the box and they'll process it at $5. But the client that I was working with this past week, we called in because they didn't process the request. They said, oh, we missed the check for the $5 forbearance. It'll show up in the next billing cycle. Next billing cycle comes. It never shows up. We call in again. And they said, oh, well, yeah, it's in your paperless inbox. And they go through the paperless inbox. It's not in there. Ultimately, the representative just says, you know what? I don't know what happened to it. We generated the bill, but we just forgot to send it out to you. Could you imagine if that was your mortgage company, like your loan company? Like you called up, you didn't pay for your mortgage. They're about ready to like foreclose on you. And they're like, you know what? Our bad. We just didn't send you the bill. Sorry about that. It's a joke.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
The funny thing was the client says, I wish they'd lose my whole account, actually.
Yeah, there was another case, I think, a couple of weeks ago with a company sent 55,000 bills to an address accidentally.
Right.
I thought, you know, shoot, if you get 55,000 pieces of mail with your bill on it, like, I feel like they should just forgive it, you know? But so that's interesting. So also we have a lot of people doing PSLF, obviously, that listen to this because there's a lot of anxiety. And I love people listening to our podcast, but I know that the people that listen to every single one of these, you know, you're probably a little bit more anxious than average, you know, compared to the average consumer. Otherwise, you'd be listening to true crime podcasts. I like to think that we're entertaining, but, you know, I admit that we're not as exciting as, you know, Who Killed Who. But, you know, talk a little bit about, you know, some of these capped payment problems, right? So, like, I definitely have seen a lot of people getting stuff from, like, Fed Loan Servicing that are no longer having a partial financial hardship. And the thing that's smart to do is to basically, we figured out, just ignore that letter. Don't call Fed Loan Servicing, because if you do, they'll put you onto a uncapped payment plan. So if you basically ignore the letter, you keep getting credit towards PSLF with a lower payment. Is that something that you're seeing similarly, or do you have any extra things to add to that?
Yeah, I have a couple of things to add about the public service loan forgiveness. Gosh, every topic I have some things to add. The payment cap is very beneficial. And one of the challenges for borrowers, if they just graduate from school and they let the servicer choose their repayment plan for them, even if the payment calculates the same in pay-as-you-earn, income-based repayment, revised pay-as-you-earn, because they had next to no income on their previous tax return because they had just graduated, right? The default for the loan servicer is to put them into revised pay-as-you-earn. Revised pay-as-you-earn does not have a payment cap. So as income increases, individuals that are maybe hoping for public service loan forgiveness could end up paying all their loans off in full before the 10 years occurs. Now, for individuals that alternatively choose their repayment plan and choose, say, pay-as-you-earn or income-based repayment, those payment plans have a payment cap, meaning the payment cannot exceed what you would have paid when you entered into repayment if you were paying your loans off over 10 years. And in order to get into one of those plans, you have to have a partial financial hardship. So you were either paying it off at a slower pace earlier on, or you're not paying it off at all, and you actually have an increasing loan balance. Those payments, if your income later increases and you hit that cap, are called the permanent standard payment. That payment is a qualifying payment towards public service loan forgiveness. So if somebody has low income for 3 or 4 years and has qualifying payments, if they hit that payment cap, they will still eventually have some debt left over at the end of 120 payments for public service loan forgiveness. If they were in revised pay as you earn, that may not be the case. This is especially important for maybe physicians that are going to be attending at a hospital where they are a direct employee of a hospital versus physicians that may be, not completing their actual employment with a nonprofit hospital, maybe through a physicians group or something like that. So yeah, those payment caps can come in very, very handy, but it's also important to realize that some of the payment plans don't have payment caps. And whether or not you assess the value of that payment cap is really depends upon facts and circumstances of the borrower.
Yeah. But like for Fed loans specifically, they scare the heck out of people. Like they send them a letter when their payment's too high for their income on pay as you earn. And they have a giant phone number. Call this phone number, if you have questions about this. And so what does everybody do? Right. I mean, that's pretty scary to get told that you no longer qualify. So you call. And then you call the $10, $15 an hour phone rep and they tell everybody to switch to repay because that's what the default payment plan is, right? So, I mean, so for some of these physicians, they're paying a lot more than they really need to be paying, right?
Yeah, or even worse, they'll say, oh, well, we can get you in a payment plan where your payment's lower, get you into an extended payment plan from here, right? So then you're not making qualifying payments at all, right? And while Fed loans is awful, I do have to take a step back sometimes. They have a very difficult job. It doesn't give them
extremely hard
right to be as awful as they are. But before 2009, when the only income-driven repayment plan was ICR, you had to have direct loans, and that was the smallest portion of the federal portfolio. Loan servicers just had to calculate regular amortized payments like any other loan servicer.
That's pretty easy to do.
Right. And the advent of these income-driven repayment plans has increased the complexity tenfold, especially when you figure so many of the borrowers don't really understand the forms or the repayment options. I have to imagine a good majority of borrowers that are navigating their system on their own are sending in incomplete forms, incorrect supporting documentations of income. And that's just got to be so much more labor intensive for the loan servicers. Not to mention, under the old FFELP program, they were originators of the loan. So they had a much higher spread on what they were making. Now they get paid servicing fees and they still get paid plenty of money, and that's their responsibility. They took the job, they should be better at it. But they're having to do significantly more work on less revenue. And that's always a recipe for disaster when you talk about customer service.
Well, I think people don't realize that, right? You said a super important point. The servicers used to make origination money on all of the debt with the FFELP program, correct?
Correct. Sallie Mae was a large private equity firm that would source dollars that were federally guaranteed and then issued to borrowers. And they got a much larger spread on that than they did on the servicing part of it.
Yeah, like a huge amount. I mean, so that stopped. And so you're going to ask people to provide a level of service for a flat cost. And the contract, it's a low bid contract, isn't it? I mean, basically, like when people are submitting for it.
Yes, yeah, it's based upon the total of assets that they're servicing is what they get paid. But it's a small percentage of the interest that's being collected, not interest, but of the balance. So, they have taken a haircut on their revenues and are required to do significantly more. And that's why they have poor training, high turnover at the call center. And for them to say that borrowers don't need a financial professional to help them navigate this, just talk to our loan counselor that got a day and a half of training and has no financial background or any licenses is a bit absurd.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense why they're saying it, because in theory, you shouldn't need that because you paid a lot of fees, origination fees, things that should theoretically pay for good counseling. But it's kind of like anything. It's like the more complicated the system is, the more you can probably figure out ways to game it. So that's kind of what current status is, right? So let's talk a little bit about long-term student loans, right? So you've got uncapped borrowing. You've got a lot of people saying that needs to be capped. I think there's even bipartisan consensus in some regards that I think that there needs to be a change in like the cap of, just in what people can borrow. So, I mean, if you have a crystal ball here, I mean, what do you think happens with the amount of student loans people can borrow? Do you think it gets capped at some point, and you have any predictions on that, or you think it just stays uncapped for another decade?
I have two thoughts, but let me first go back to public service loan forgiveness. I do want to make one comment for people that are listening and are nervous. The GAO studies and the headlines that come out about public service loan forgiveness strike a lot of fear in individuals, and they feel as if the government is purposely denying people or they're making it difficult to achieve public service loan forgiveness. The fact of the matter is the government is administering the laws per the contract that was put in place. And people 10 years ago didn't really understand what was required of them. It's partly, again, the fault of the loan servicers. It's partly the fault of the Department of Education because they did a poor job explaining this to individuals. And it's, you know, some has to fall on the shoulders of borrowers that have debt and aren't aware of their obligations if they want to meet certain qualifications. But when you look at those numbers and they say things like 99% of borrowers are denied for public service loan forgiveness. Well, you and I know, Travis, that you have to make 120 payments. 80% of the people that applied for public service loan forgiveness, or roughly 80%, hadn't even been in repayment for 10 years. So when you see the headline number and it says, hey, people aren't getting the forgiveness that they're applying for, well, yeah, that's true. But when 80% of the people applying haven't even had their loans in repayment long enough to meet the 10-year requirement, yet they're still applying, it misrepresents some of the facts and gives borrowers anxiety. I've talked to a number of borrowers that had just done a private refinance when they were going through public service loan forgiveness because they didn't believe it was a reality for them anymore. And that's, gosh, that's just an awful decision. And something that I personally feel there's liability on the shoulders of the private lenders too, to understand that and not even take that debt on, right? I mean, that would be the right thing to do in their cases. So I do want to put those people that are in public service loan forgiveness a little bit at ease. You can look through your contract of your loans, your master promissory note. You can see that public service loan forgiveness is contractually obligated. It was passed into law. Any of the news articles that you hear, budget requests that have to do with eliminating or reducing public service loan forgiveness are all for new borrowers because the government knows they can't really mess with the contract that you currently have and the agreement that you signed when you borrowed your loans.
So I got a fun one here. So here's this analogy that I came up with, Chance. You can tell me if it's ridiculous, but let's pretend that we're all going to go eat at Olive Garden tonight. Okay. Yeah, I love it. It's awesome, right? Unlimited breadsticks, golly. So basically fed me throughout all college. I'm joking a little bit, but good place. Okay, so we're going to go to Olive Garden. You tell everybody is told in an entire social group, we're going to eat at Olive Garden tonight, okay? And there's this very important document that we want you to read with the instructions, you know, for that, okay? And so in that document, it says Olive Garden opens at 6 p.m., okay? And now we have people show up for dinner at 5:30. So what percent of the people that showed up early, like before the instructions said to show up at 6 p.m., didn't read the directions or didn't understand the directions, right? So in other words, the people that read that form and understood they're not supposed to show up until 6 p.m., those people all didn't show up, right? Because they knew that they didn't qualify, so they didn't show up. But if you ask, you know, what is a rejection rate? Well, obviously, you're going to get way more people showing up that hadn't read the directions than people who did read the directions. So you basically have this false, it's like a selection bias problem, and it's never been really reported in the media or discussed in the media, but like naturally the people who didn't read the directions are the most likely to apply when they shouldn't have. So that explains one reason why the numbers of people getting rejected are so large. Now you might say, well, okay, that's a little unfair because some of the people didn't have qualifying loans. I mean, I can't, my Olive Garden analogy breaks down here. So yes, some of the people had non-qualifying loans and everything and got misleading advice. Like people got probably somebody said, oh, hey, maybe Olive Garden's open earlier today. And then maybe you have some people that showed up at 5:30 just hoping that they would let them in the doors anyway. You know what I mean? So right. It's kind of like, that's one of the reasons I think why this PSLF reporting is kind of a little bogus is just because it's not taking into account that the program literally is set up to work just fine. And I know that our Google traffic kind of like exploded the other day because people started searching about Trump repealing PSLF in his latest budget. And obviously that's not happening. And even in the latest budget, it said specifically for new borrowers only. You know, it's just amazing how much misinformation is out there regarding that program.
I'm not going to give those services a pass, though, because while that's the case, right, people had wrong loans and all these other things, the processes weren't in place. Like you couldn't do an employment certification for a long period of time. There's lawsuits now that Fed Loans certified that the American Bar Association was a qualifying nonprofit, and they've gone back and tried to take those qualifying payments away after the fact. There are certainly people. I have a client who, you know, is requesting her payment history from Fed Loans because she's been in repayment for 8 years. She's been on auto pay the whole time, but they only have 5 years worth of payments because her loans were at Navient or Sallie Mae before then. So it's right. not to say that the system isn't flawed and that Department of Education, Fed Loan Servicing, and other servicers have not dropped the ball on this as well. But I think that the reaction of individuals is, hey, I'm going to change my plans. I'm just going to pay my loans off. I'm going to do a private refinance instead. And they're doing that out of fear from what's being represented in the news versus the facts of what the actual, you know, reality is if they were to continue to stay the course.
Yeah. So let's talk about just how smart it is that the government is selling off all of their best loans to private lenders. What is your opinion about that?
Well, so first of all, you have to look at this from the standpoint that the federal loan portfolio, the direct loans portfolio, is the largest asset held by the United States government, which is kind of unfathomable, right? That's just, there's that much debt that they have issued that they hold this huge asset. But as a former bond trader, Travis, if you were managing an asset, and especially when you're managing an asset as a collateralized loan obligation, basically, you realize that within that asset, there's going to be some charge-offs. There's going to be some houses in a mortgage-backed asset where some mortgages are going to default. You're going to have, in credit cards, you're going to have charge-off. It's part of the business, right? But you also realize that you have made a lot of good loans, and the reality, the net benefit there is that your good loans are going to offset significantly more than your bad loans. Well, the Department of Education and the U.S. government runs the absolute worst bond portfolio that you could imagine, because they look at their book and they say, okay, well, all of those great loans that we made, those physicians making $400,000 a year that have $150,000 in student debt, that we should get paid in full and collect interest on this money over the next 5-10 years. We're going to go ahead and sell these off to private institutions. But what we're going to keep on our books are all the people that borrowed $200,000 and only have $50,000 in income. And those are the ones we're going to keep. So their mismanagement of the portfolio is a big problem as to why the income-driven repayment plans are coming under scrutiny, is because the revenue-producing portion of their portfolio, they're selling to private interest, and they're keeping and retaining the worst portion of their portfolio. And it's just a classic government disaster of how they're managing their portfolio. I honestly think that what they should do is remove bankruptcy provisions for private student loan lenders, which would significantly increase those interest rates. And then they would be more likely to maintain their good loans on the books and recoup the interest from those, which they can use to offset the losses that they would have on the bad loans they make.
Yeah. I mean, certainly pretty interesting, problem, right? And you could argue that their goal is not to get a return on assets, as you know, the federal government, their return is to get a positive return for society, whatever that means. Some people arguing, well, why don't you charge lower interest rates? I mean, that's certainly one way you could do it if you want to subsidize that. I mean, but you probably need to have caps on borrowing, because otherwise, like, why wouldn't I take out a $10 million loan at 0% interest that I can go invest in a bond at getting 2%, right?
Right.
It is pretty interesting, but it's not limited to student loans. I mean, like, you think about like the federal flood insurance program. It's like anybody that lives on a mountain can, you know, qualify for private flood insurance program. But anybody who lives in a floodplain, well, let's insure them with the federal system. I mean, so, you know, there's a lot of problems like that, I think, in a lot of different programs that kind of leave, you know, the average taxpayer footing the bill for the most situations that you wouldn't normally see be able to qualify for something, because maybe it's not a good idea.
Right. And I think that a lot of the scrutiny in public service loan forgiveness and the income-driven repayment plans that is making its way through Congress is because, though they don't want to make money, although they certainly have not had a problem making money on student loans up until this point, they're concerned that what has been revenue producing or is designed to be budget neutral is going to be a subsidy, meaning it's going to cost them more than what they're bringing in. And that's what they don't want to have happen. But it's sort of short-sighted when you see some of these articles and studies that say that the student loans are going to cost the government and taxpayers X number of dollars. Because there are additional benefits of having student loans and the access to higher education that still bring the government in revenue that maybe aren't directly tied to payments and forgiven debt, right? There is a high correlation between education attainment and income. And there is 100% in this country correlation between income and income tax revenue, right? So even if you break even or lose a little bit of money on your loan portfolio, but you are creating higher income earning citizens that are paying higher taxes, you'll likely recoup the difference. Plus, a good part of the access to education and having student loans issued through the Department of Education and having enough liquidity to do it is that we have a stronger workforce that's more competitive in the global landscape if we have more educated individuals. If you think back to when the FFELP program really fell apart, it was during the credit crunch, and the direct loans program had to step up to fill the difference because there wasn't enough dollars available to lend, and they were going to be individuals that weren't going to be receiving dollars from the federal loan program because there wasn't enough dollars there. So I think you have to look at it at a bigger scale than just the student loan portfolio, although I do think that the government is very misguided in selling off their best assets and keeping the worst ones. There are reforms that certainly need to happen. I think that one of the challenges for undergraduate borrowers is the borrowing limits. Freshmen can only borrow $5,500 a year. Well, what does that cover at today's education costs, right? So then they're either forced to go to the private market or get Parent PLUS loans that now we're saddling parents with debt for their adult children that, you know, these are adults. Maybe they should continue to be able to take out the debt in their names instead of putting on the parents' ledger.
Yeah, a lot that you could talk about there. So I mean, you think about in terms of how much extra yield that you have to get to lend to a risky borrower. So I made a YouTube video about this, a couple of days ago for the Student Loan Planner YouTube channel, where I basically talked about how rates are at a record low and credit spreads are at a record low. And what credit spread means is, if you have somebody that's risky, investors, how much extra yield do you have to get to give your money to somebody who's risky that might not pay you back versus just giving it to the government and they're going to pay you back, right? So right now, like for, a triple B bond, which is kind of like a risky company, you can get, only need basically a 1 to 1.5% extra yield to lend to that real risky borrower. But back in 2008 and 2009, you needed an extra, 8 or 9% or even 10%, I think was the absolute peak. And so if you think about a private student loan in that environment, so your treasury bond is 3% and you need a 10% credit spread to invest in that as a private investor. So now you have interest rates available to student loan borrowers that have to be at 13%. And that's if you can get capital at all. And then that the FICO score minimum would probably have risen from 650 to 750. So that excludes millions of people that now have to drop out of school. So I definitely think there's definitely a smart role for the government to play in the student loan industry. The million-dollar question is what is it? And so for the next last section, Jan, so I just want to, we have an election coming up, right? So I know that I'm probably a little bit more of a political junkie. Sometimes we'll watch CNN for fun, the debate coverages and things like that. So I'm just going to read off a couple different names and maybe we have a brief conversation about each one of their student loan plans. So the first one is kind of a little bit of a dark horse. I'm not really exactly sure what his plan is, but Buttigieg, have you ever heard anything about his plan mentioned before?
I haven't. I know there's a resource where you can kind of get a breakdown of each one of their student loan plans. The reality is higher education reauthorization needs to happen. It's been due for a long time. The challenge is going to be is can anyone get a bipartisan bill through for something like higher education authorization with the polarization that's occurred? But I don't know any specifics about his particular plan.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a general Democratic plan, which I think that basically it means expanding protections for people that went to for-profit schools, like forgiving that debt more, probably doing something to lower the interest rate. I mean, Democrats certainly talk about refinancing federal debt to lower interest rates quite a bit. Have seen no interest in doing that on the Republican side. Just because, I think their view is, well, if the private sector is able to do it, then we should let them do it, right? So I think that, Democrats would be more likely to offer lower interest rates. And then, I think, according to some of the stuff I've read, is, again, supports expanding public service loan forgiveness, probably making that a little bit easier to attain. So nothing kind of super different from sort of party orthodoxy about him. Now, Bernie, obviously, Senator Sanders has a very different plan. Let's forgive it all. Thoughts on this one?
Well, I think when you say forgive it all, I think he's only referencing federal student loans. It would be very difficult to forgive it all and have buy-in to just pay off private companies that have purchased federal student loans. So it's something that I think could provide a great economic benefit to a lot of people, right? I mean, we've had a lot of federal programs that have, over the last couple of years, been very beneficial to the people at higher incomes, those individuals that have more assets. With the low interest rates and the increase in stock market, and a lot of people on the lower side have been left out. I mean, when you look at the people that are defaulting on student debt, the average student loan balance that's being defaulted on is only 8 to $10,000. So that would be something that would be more beneficial to lower income individuals. I actually had an interesting conversation a week or so ago about how a president could actually believe that they have executive authority to step in day one and wipe out student debt. And I really couldn't find anything in the statutes that would back that up other than the initial act that created income contingent repayment that doesn't define the term or amount of payment that's being paid. It's up to the discretion of the Secretary of Education. So I think that's how it could be done, but I think it may be hard pressed to get done, unfortunately, in reality.
And also too, if this is sort of the Democratic Party orthodoxy now, like President Obama could have done that and he didn't. And why is that? I mean, I think partly it's because you would get an immediate challenge by conservative courts. And I don't think for a second that a Republican, you know, dominated Supreme Court would pass that. So also, you know, that's a good segue into Senator Warren's plan. So Sanders' plan is to forgive all of it, all federal debt. And then Warren's plan is to, instead of $1.6 trillion, let's forgive about $600 billion. And that's going to be for your people that, you know, have incomes less than 100 grand, gets phased out, and they're only forgiving $50,000 maximum. That's at least, I read that plan. That's a lot more well thought out plan in terms of, you know, how we pay for it and what, who's going to get it and why, and let's make it less regressive, right?
Right. And it sort of mimics a little bit the proposals that President Obama had in his budget request. If you recall, he actually was attempting to cap public service loan forgiveness on only $57,000 in a couple of his budgets. So it's probably more in line of saying, hey, we're going to help any individuals that are on the lower income side. Certainly, it wouldn't be as much of a benefit to those that went to professional schools or graduate schools. It's really going to be a benefit if something like that were to go into those individuals that only have an undergraduate degree or only borrowed for undergraduate studies. It's going to be the lower income and lower debt loads that are going to benefit from that. But again, I think it would be under the same law of ICR where they have that discretion to forgive loans after a certain period of time after making a certain percentage of payment based upon income.
Yeah. And I think that I might get some hate mail for this podcast, studentloanplanner.com, if you want to send me hate mail. But, you know, I think Democrats love public servants and Republicans love contracts. And so if you look at those two things, Democrats want to do nothing but expand public service loan forgiveness. The last time we've ever heard a Democrat say, hey, let's limit it, was back with Obama's budgets in 2015 kind of timeframe. Ever since then, everybody wants to expand it and make it more generous, right? And then Republicans obviously never want to create a precedent of having somebody have a promissory note that says something and then try to pull the rug out from under them. That's very anathema to sort of a business focused, you know, approach to politics, right? So a couple more to cover here. Biden, so his plan is 5% of your income. My thought on his plan was like, well, if you're going to let people pay 5% of your income, why not just do Bernie or Warren's plan? I mean, just, you know, because nobody's going to pay anything if you can do a 5% of your income tax with no tax bomb. I mean, shoot, sign me up for some student loans if that's the case, right?
Right. I think ultimately the income-driven repayment plans, although the administration of them is a nightmare from a, you know, 10,000 foot view, I think they're actually a fair way to administer the federal student loan portfolio, because basically you're saying, hey, we're willing to lend to you to improve your lifestyle and help you become a more productive person in our workforce. But we want to give you some fail safes in there. And you can either pay your loans off in full, or you can make payments based upon your income if your education didn't pan out, and we'll forgive the difference. So I actually think from a policy standpoint, the general concept is good. The practical application is very muddied. And obviously, I think who gets to have access to those Title IV funds from a school standpoint is something that needs to be looked at. There needs to be, if you're providing those fail safes, that it's just not a cash cow for certain schools to be producing individuals that are not going to be having great incomes or enhancing their lives. Because ultimately, that's what the individuals are going to school for. I mean, even those that go to, you know, University of Phoenix, as you mentioned before, and have the corporate logos there, I mean, they're going there because they want to better their lives. And if it doesn't pan out for them, we do need to have a fail safe, because otherwise they're just going to wander in that debt and not be productive at all.
Okay, so say if we had Mike Bloomberg or Senator Klobuchar win, or one of the other moderates, I mean, it seems like they might do the Higher Education Act reauthorization and just do 10% of your income for 20 years and then no tax bomb, in which case I think we'd have a lot of people switch to that. So I mean, do you feel like that's the most likely scenario with the Higher Ed Act reauthorization?
I do, because I think the general idea of the income-driven repayment plans is good. You know, with regards to the tax bomb, and even some of the conversation we had earlier about public service loan forgiveness, you kind of have to look back at the intent of the law. One of the, I think, the criticisms of public service loan forgiveness is it's actually too broad, because many people believe that the idea of having public service loan forgiveness and these income-driven repayment plans is really to help lower-income borrowers, not to help those individuals that may be a juror, an attorney, or someone's working for a nonprofit that's maybe making $100,000, $150,000, $200,000 a year. Certainly, I don't think the intent was to provide a student loan benefit to a physician making $400,000 a year through public service loan forgiveness, right? So I'm actually curious to see how the tax component works out, whether or not they're willing to or interested in saying there's no tax consequence from this, because we already have insolvency rules that are in place. So if a borrower is insolvent when those loans are forgiven or the day before those loans are forgiven, then they don't have to pay taxes on the amount that's forgiven. And it is somewhat of a clawback, I feel, to catch some of the income lost or forgiven on those loans from those high income earners. I agree with you that a more moderate proposal is going to look something similar to what we already have, but I am interested to see how they kind of work on the purse strings with the tax component and whether or not they could see that as a way to sort of claw back dollars from those individuals that maybe do have really high net worths when they're having public service loan forgiveness or other loan forgiveness that occurs.
Sure. And, you know, and if Trump wins, President Trump wins re-election, then I feel like we probably will be in for another 4 years of nothing changing, I would assume. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I can't imagine the bipartisanship is going to be high if Trump wins again, as it hasn't. It seems to be reaching close to a crescendo, is about as polarizing as it can get there. So I don't see any mending of fences if we have the current administration and the current makeup of Congress. I don't see any mending of fences anytime soon there.
Well, yeah. So then we'll have you on in 2024 when student loans are at $3 trillion, and we'll ask you what to do now, right? Well, Jansen, right. Thanks so much for being on the show. Where can people find more out about what you do?
Yeah, Travis, they can reach me at cslainstitute.org. That is the nonprofit's website for those financial advisors that are interested in working or learning student loan repayment, incorporating it into their businesses. Also for borrowers, if you're looking for a tax advisor or certified financial planner that has a CSLP designation, you can find them there. And you can also catch me at CSLA Financial, which is the website for my advisory firm.
Thanks so much for being on the show, Jantz.
Thanks for having me, Travis.
Thanks for listening to today's show. If you're ready to schedule your custom student loan plan, visit studentloanplanner.com/book and pick a time that works for you. The show notes are available at studentloanplanner.com/the number of today's episode. Finally, if you love your Student Loan Planner podcast, help us out and leave us a review or share it with someone who owes more than you.